Powered by Riverside.
Another episode of That's Too Bad. I've been away for quite some time. I understand that. I know that. Traveling, weddings, family functions, and so forth. But glad to be back recording and talking our favorite subject, our only subject, and it's game golf here. And let's be honest here. Since the last time we've chatted, and since I've chatted, a lot has happened. We've had the first major happen. And, I just want to, let's dive right into that. The Masters was definitely an interesting tournament this year. And it's always interesting and exciting, and there's always drama and different storylines, year after year. I think the biggest storyline here is Scotty Scheffler. Beating a dead horse, I'm sure, with the media, the Golf Channel, social media, all across the board, all these other podcasts. I've already probably talked about Scotty Scheffler, right? Here's the thing. I think my last episode or two episodes ago, I think I had mentioned, Scotty is, he's not on Tiger Woods' trajectory yet, but I see glimpses of an early Tiger Woods as far as more of like the success and really pure dominance. I mean, I mentioned before, and I think I've tweeted it out, and that's, the switch from the blade putter to his now mallet putter has really made a huge difference. Not in just his putting, but the overall course of his game. He's been one of the best ball strikers on tour. Everybody knows that. That's going back over a year and a half now. And the missing piece, especially from last year, was his putting. And he makes this dramatic switch to a mallet putter, which I think for the pros, when you play with one style of putter for so long and you make a switch, an equipment switch, I mean, you usually think there's a little bit of lag time to get acclimated, get the feel of it. For Scotty, that had to have been like 24 hours because right out the gate, he started playing extremely well. We started seeing Scotty from over a year and a half ago, and we're continuing to see his pure dominance. We saw it at the Masters. The Masters this year was quite, it's going to be difficult because it's a major. And Augusta National, I've never played it. You can only read and listen to what the pros talk about and all the golf analysts, and it's a tough course. This year especially, the winds on Thursday, Friday, I think really posed a huge challenge for the golfers. You saw a lot of guys ending up short of the green or, clearing the green completely. And that was due to just the wind taking the ball. Really not so much the yardage factor themselves, but either miscalculated the wind or didn't calculate the wind at all for some of them. And we saw a lot of higher scores. And so I was looking at the scoreboard at the end of Sunday, and we only had 8 golfers in the entire field below. And for a major, that's wild to me. It almost brings me back to, some of those open championships over in Europe there, where, a few years ago, I think it was, where it was playing so difficult because of weather and conditions that I think the winner at one point, again, this could be even longer than a few years ago, and it really, I think, was like 6-7 under, something like that. So it was, kind of a wild Masters just from that aspect. Watching it throughout the 4 days and even like the par 3 contest. I noticed that the greens were very slick and quick. And again, that's to be expected of a major championship. but for some reason it just seemed, it just kind of stuck out to me this year was even quicker greens. And I don't know if that had anything to do with weather or conditions out there. You could definitely tell, though, it was playing a major factor. A lot of putts were missed, you know, and not missed drastically. They were missed. It was missed slightly. You know, they would miss on the high side or the low side. And what was crazy is when you know how greens are that quick, it's how they just continue to run and keep going. You barely touch the ball, you think it's barely going to make it to the hole, and yet here it goes, it just continues going. And we definitely saw a couple of those throughout the tournament. Overall, though, I mean, this Masters was exciting. I mean, we definitely had, again, like every major, like every year, we got storylines. Scotty definitely is one of the big storylines with his wife soon to, you know, they're about to have their first child. You kept hearing the rumors that he was kind of pulling a Phil Mickelson from years ago where he had somebody walking with his group and had his cell phone on standby in case something happened. We've heard that he could potentially leave early if she did go into labor, even though, you know, I think I read or saw on Twitter or something that she's not due for a while, or I don't want to say a while, but it's definitely at least another month or month and a half. So, but you never know, I guess, for pregnancy. So, that really, I think, became a bigger storyline than I think it really needed to be. I think Scotty, you saw in press conferences and everything else after each round, it kept getting brought up. You could tell he was kind of just getting sick of the same question over and over again. And to be honest, I think that happens a lot in golf. It's the same damn questions from the media over and over again. You've seen it time to time. Brooks Koepka kind of rolls his eyes. Tiger Woods has done it before, you can tell. I don't blame him either. After about the fifth, sixth different time, you know, what it's like they're just hoping you slip up or give you the wrong answer. The other storyline, though, I thought was huge, not even a storyline, just overall performance in the whole Masters, was the guy that finished second place, and that's Ludvig Åberg. I was just watching his highlights through the last round of the Masters not too long ago here. This guy's got such an effortless swing. It really just seems like he's just kind of, I don't want to say going through the motions, but it's kind of what it looks like. He's just, he brings the club back, great backswing, comes through, follow through. And it's almost like, you know, he's not trying to be like Rory and drive his knee and hip into the ground, his left leg, and, you know, overpower the ball. Yet this guy can hit it a mile. And what I noticed, too, in the final round was his control with his wedges and his low irons there were some of the best shots throughout the tournament. And his putting, too, was, you know, above average for that tournament, at least when you're comparing it to the rest of the field. This guy's got a lot of talent. And you could definitely see why Luke Donald had him on the Ryder Cup team. This guy's a gamer. And I definitely am going to predict that he is going to be contending for not just, you know, regular tournaments throughout the season. We're going to see him again at the PGA and the U.S. Open, and I guarantee he'll be up there contending, and if not, potentially winning his first major. Great to see him and how he performed there. I'm looking forward to seeing how he plays. I definitely have never really seen what his style of play is, or really even know too much about him until the Masters weekend. I mean, I remember watching him during the Ryder Cup, but that's about it. I love what I saw from him, and he's definitely going to be one of these guys that I'll be kind of tuning in throughout the season moving forward to see how he's been doing in these tournaments here on out. Another big story. And I think it's a story that it's not even a story. One of the bigger topics, or whatever you want to call it, is the performance of Bryson DeChambeau. Goes out, and I mean, he's looking like he's out there on a mission, man on a mission, first 2 days, really first 2.5 days. Plays extremely well. I mean, typical Bryson. He's pounding the ball, he's getting it close, and he's making his putts. I mean, say what you want about the guy and his science background and everything else that I think drives people nuts about him. When he gets on the greens, he is definitely one of the better putters in all of it. His reading of greens and understanding the speeds and the slopes, he's definitely got a, you know, patent down for what he's doing. Now, he does take a little bit longer on the greens to do so, which I know frustrates other golfers, and it really does kill the kind of speed of play a little bit. And, you know, I've generally been known as a quick, speedy golfer. I get frustrated when I'm playing with, you know, someone that might be a little bit slower, at least if it's not something I'm well aware of going into that round, who I'm paired up with or so forth. You know, I can see why it's frustrating, you know. He walks around the whole putting green, looks at all the angles, and the math and science starts kicking in. He's calculating it to a degree and speed, and it's when you're not playing, it's a little it's fascinating, but it's something I'll never try to replicate or understand. I'm not smart enough to probably understand it, and that's why it's worked for him for really since he's been on tour, and you know, why he's been one of the top putters, you know, live, PGA Tour, whatever you want to call it, both sides of it, he's always been a pretty good putter. And, you know, people might, you know, put an asterisk because he does the arm lock putter. Listen, I've been one of these people for a long time that says arm lock, belly putter, you know, the broomstick, the claw, whatever your style is, doesn't mean shit. I've still never understood why we ban the belly putter so much, and why golfers are trying to get rid of the arm lock putters. Golfers are going to find different ways to change up putting, because putting really, at the end of the day, is a feel. And if you're feeling uncomfortable over the ball when you're trying to putt, you're not going to make it. That's just how I've always viewed putting. And he's, you know, has that arm lock putter down. And again, it's just because you arm lock, it doesn't guarantee it's going in the hole every time. You still have to get a feel for it. There's different styles of arm lock. Bryson is very stiff. You know, his left arm is very straight to his shoulder. His right arm is pretty close to being the same. He's very upright. You can see, like, Matt Kuchar's been doing the arm lock putter as long as, you know, Jesus, Bryson's been alive, it seems like. Probably, you know, exaggerating here, but he's done now two different versions of the arm lock putter. He's got traditional, where it's up against his left forearm. I mean, he's more crouched than Bryson DeChambeau. And over the last 2 years, he's gone what I guess you would call it a reverse. It's now on his right arm. I tried dumbing the putting shaft here once to see how that would feel. I don't understand how he does that on a consistent basis. It just feels odd to me. Like, you want the shaft to almost come off your forearm before you make contact. I don't know. But, you know, I've seen him interview and say that this works, and that, you know, he would encourage people to try it. And again, it's all a feel of what you're comfortable on the putting. You go traditional blade putters, male putters, etc. And that's why I've never understood why the belly putter got banned from the tour. Realistically here, I think what the blessing in disguise was is that it brought us the arm lock putter. But circling back to DeChambeau in the Masters, and that Saturday afternoon, that back nine especially, really ate him up. Ended Saturday on a high note. What was he, like 120-something out? Dunks it, one hops it in under the 18th. You think he's kind of salvaged going into Sunday? He's only a couple behind. You know, Scotty's, again, putting a lot of pressure because he played phenomenal Saturday going into Sunday. Max Homa, another guy, he just kind of like just kept hanging around. A guy that I just kept begging to try to get more birdies. And one of these guys that just was par after par after par. And you can't make up ground with just pars, especially in the major. He didn't play bad, but he didn't play great, is how I viewed Max Homa. And he is a great golfer. This guy's going to win majors down the road. I really thought going into Saturday this was going to be Max Homa's first major. And because I thought at least going into Saturday and Sunday, the wind's dying down. So the conditions were more favorable for the golfers, and I was expecting maybe some lower scores, and I mean, I was wrong on that part, and the other part that Max Homa was going to come and essentially try to light it up to win his first major, and it just didn't happen. He just, again, just kept making pars. I think he had a couple bogeys here and there from Sunday where he ended up dropping a couple spots, but again, just by the time he finally started kind of getting, I think, one or two birdies, it was just too late. And again, too, when Scotty's out here, you know, finishes the Masters minus 11 to win, that's, you got to make a lot of birdies to keep up with it. You know, I'm looking back at, I mean, Oberg was 7 under to finish the tournament. So, I mean, Scotty really pulled away. And when you look at the final round, I mean, Scotty shot 4 under, Oberg shot 3 under, Fleetwood was 3 under. You know, there was a lot of 3 under rounds here, not even a lot, just a couple more Zalatoris. Other than that, it was a lot of even, plus 1, minus 1. Max Homa finished plus 1 for round 4. I mean, he finished tied for 3rd at minus 4. You know, tied for 3rd in the majors, outstanding. When the leader finishes minus 11, though, and you finish plus 1 for that round, I mean, even if he shot minus 4, he still is taking 3rd place, probably solo at that point. If not, he's tied for 2nd with Oberg. He really needed to do a lot of damage Saturday and Sunday to stick with Scotty, and it just didn't happen. And, you know, nothing that I think going into the PGA, though, he needs to change. It's just got to drain the putts, got to sink when they count. When you're on in 2 and par 5s and birdies and pars, par 4s you're on in 2, you got to make the birdies, you got to get it close. And then really it's the par 3s. If you can get close on certain par 3s and sink those birdies, you start pulling away from the field, which is what Scotty is. And so, I mean, between DeChambeau, really, who blew up Sunday, it was back and forth Saturday. Again, the guy thought, hey, this guy's, he's out for revenge after last year, who, again, you know, DeChambeau was up there with Brooks Koepka and Phil Mickelson, fell short. I thought Brooks and DeChambeau were going to go into this year's Masters out for blood. DeChambeau came out firing, Koepka didn't. Get to Saturday, and the wheels just started falling. And Sunday was just not good for DeChambeau at all. But, I mean, that's what makes the Masters fun to watch. And really, all the majors in general. Okay. So I wrote this down, part of my notes. Do I want to bring it up and talk about it? Yes and no. And that's Tiger Woods at the Masters. Now, everybody's got their own opinion on Tiger Woods, on how did it go. And I've agreed with what I've read from some golf analysts, and I've disagreed with others. And same with some of these social media people out there. You know, I think some of the shit that's been said about how he was during the tournament was to just get likes and views and whatever. I think some stuff is wrong, out of proportion. But anyways, Tiger Woods, the version that we saw at the Masters, is not your typical Tiger Woods, who's now got many multiple Masters green jackets. We saw glimpses of Tiger Woods. And really here for Tiger, it's, yes, will it be awesome to see him win another major? Of course. But this year, I think mainly, and I think he's got this set as his goal. Because, I mean, his goal has been to play, one tournament a month. Because, I mean, his body is still not 100% from all the fusion surgeries, physical therapy, just overall wear and tear. I mean, he even said to a reporter during the Masters, everything. But the guy's still waking up at 4 a.m. He's still working out. He's still going for his run. I mean, the guy's still doing his routine. I'm sure it's altered now at his age and with all his aching body parts. The guy is still doing what he's been doing for a long time. And what I noticed during the Masters was off the tee, I saw glimpses of good drives. Some that got away, obviously. Tiger Woods, I think, has always been known for, aggressive off the tee and sometimes puts him in danger. It's what has made him quite the artist to get out of dangerous and interesting situations on the golf course. The biggest thing I think I noticed from Tiger Woods the whole Masters, though, was his short game was if he could get it close with his 56-60 degree, whether he was in the rough, in the fairway, in the bunkers, he put himself in position to succeed with his wedge. The putting, again, just wasn't 100% there, like I mentioned before, with kind of the whole field, the putting really wasn't. That's definitely something for Tiger Woods to build off of. I would, anticipate that's what we're going to see. If he decides to play in the upcoming PGA Championship, I personally think he's going to give that one a go. But, time will tell. In a couple of weeks, we'll find out. And we'll see what happens at the PGA Championship here. But overall, Tiger Woods you can definitely tell it's just not what we all want to see. We want to see him dominate, but it's just, maybe he's got one more in him. I hope he does. It'd be awesome to see. Again, this year, I don't know if that's going to happen. I think this is a year of just trying to get through the whole year without ending the season with more fusion surgeries, etc. I think the coolest part and the funniest part was playing Sunday, playing with an amateur from Ohio State, and Neil Shipley, I believe it was. I was reading this. I'm right after I got, I flew back to Chicago here, and there was an interview after his round, and one of the guys or reporters trying to get to know him a little bit better, and typical question, who did you look up to, to get you involved? And I think everybody's always anticipating anybody's going to really say Tiger Woods, at least if you're going to give multiple names, Tiger Woods is in the mix, and which would have led into probably, I'm sure, then you got to play with them in your final round of the Masters, blah, blah, blah. And I think what was kind of comical was he did not say Tiger Woods. The guy he's looked up to is Vijay Singh. Another great golfer. I think that one threw that reporter off because there wasn't really a follow-up question after that. I think the reporter was semi-stunned there. I found it kind of comical. You're playing with Tiger Woods in your first ever Masters as an amateur, and you're in the Sunday round, and here you are paired with one of the greatest golfers in the history of the game, and the guy that got you into golf that you looked up to, that you were probably watching all these tournaments looking out for him, is Vijay Singh, who was in the field just didn't play well either. So that's my take on Tiger Woods at the Masters, and that whole little story there. So let's shift gears here a little bit, and let's talk. I would like to just talk first about LIV Golf and the big announcement recently, which is, and I'm a big announcement, I guess, really for me, because I'm in Illinois. So this is, and I'm not far from where the individual championship tournament's going to be at now, which is at Bolingbrook Golf Club here. A lot of interesting takes I've seen this week on social media about Bolingbrook, why LIV decided to go there, etc. I got opinions on why other courses are probably not in the mix. I'm sure it has to be PGA Pro, what's the word I'm looking for, kind of influence there. I'm sure there are PGA pros who still do not respect or appreciate or favor or support LIV Golf, which is fine. That's their freedom to do so. And I'm sure there's courses in Illinois that would love to host professional golf tournaments, whether it's LIV or the PGA Tour. And here's LIV trying to stay in Illinois. They're not at a rich harvest like they were the last 2 years. They're looking for a different venue. I don't know if Rich Harvest just didn't want them anymore or something, whatever the case may be there. But they end up at Bolingbrook. And for someone who's lived, grew up 5 minutes, less than 10 minutes from Bolingbrook, a golf club there, I've played it numerous times, year after year. It's not a bad course to have a tournament at. And this isn't me being biased, because it's not one of my top courses to, like, that I enjoy playing. It's a very challenging course. It's one of these courses where if you live in the area, you play there, and it's always windy no matter what the weather is. The wind definitely plays a huge factor in that course, makes it a little bit longer, definitely makes it tougher. The greens are quick already for public golf, so you can imagine for the LIV tournament, they're going to be even quicker. And the condition of the course is always extremely well. And I think it was Barstool, one of those guys, posted a video of the driving range. And again, they're not from the area, so they don't understand that the driving picture that they posted is from the other side of the range, where a lot of the public will go just to hit balls, not playing. The range that they're going to use is the range is on the other side of the field, where the clubhouse is, where you hit balls before you go and play your 18. And it's a nicer setup. It's not mats and a little shack. So, you know, I think a lot of people are trying to downplay it a little bit, that it's not going to be that great. The course is not great for a professional golf tournament. I disagree. I mean, they have the tee boxes to make the course longer for pros. And there's a lot of challenging and fun holes out there. It will be interesting to see how they do this with parking and stuff. Is a true native of Chicago, you gotta wonder what the parking scenario for anything. But I mean, the clubhouse is, you know, really nice. The bar, the restaurant is always good, and the area overall is very good too. You know, if you're looking for stuff around the Bolingbrook area before you go into the tournament, and overall, I think the course is, if you don't got your bag with you, you're just a spectator, I'm sure walking 18 won't be that bad. So I'm intrigued. I'm planning on trying to go one of the days to the LIV tournament there in Bolingbrook. I would be stupid not to. It's basically right in my backyard at this point. I got to go see AK. Everybody knows on the podcast, I'm a big supporter. But also a lot of my favorite golfers went from the PGA to LIV, which was Brooks Koepka, Ian Poulter. I've always been a big fan of Pat Perez and so forth. So, and I would like to just see what the LIV tournament brings. I've been to PGA tournaments before, Conway Farms, Coghill, WGC events out in Ohio. So it'd be nice to see a LIV golf tournament. So again, here for people that are not from the area, it's not a shitty course. Yes, there are, I think, nicer courses. Not even nicer. I think there are better courses out there, and also in the general area that they could play at. But this is not. It's not like they're going to play at some, you know, dog track here in Illinois. The course is always pristine, and I would anticipate it would be a fun tournament. I'm very intrigued to see how the pros from Live Tour end up playing it. You know, is Rom going to obliterate the course, or is the course going to get windy and tough, and we're going to see some high scores there? I mean, we'll definitely see what happens there. All right, so not Live, I guess it is Live related and PGA related. Something that I've noticed, I read, right, you might have saw it on the Golf Channel. This goes back maybe a month and a half. It's comments that Wyndham Clark has made. Now, after last year's U.S. Open win, and kind of the Netflix show, I've been a supporter of Wyndham Clark. I've liked his style of play and what he brings to professional golf here. What I don't appreciate, or I guess what I just didn't really like, is his recent comments, and not so much recent anymore, but his comments a couple months ago that he would like to see the PGA go to a style where it's the top 100 in, I guess, the world at this point, or I guess, or maybe just the PGA. And he said he would like to see the bottom 10 or 20 relegated going in, you know, at the end of each season. So basically, you're at the bottom 20, you're relegated to, I would assume, the Corn Ferry, unless he's thinking of another tour that would have to take place or go and work with the Corn Ferry. And then you bring another, which, I mean, at that point means you lose your tour card, you go down, you got to earn it back, the next 20 come up. I mean, so, one, I have a hard time with this speak for a couple of reasons. One is, the guy has just recently won last year U.S. Open. He ends up on the Ryder Cup. As we all know, USA doesn't win the Ryder Cup. Not saying that this was specifically on him, but I'm just saying, you know, he's on the team, and the team did not perform well, so he's a part of it. And then this year, so far in 2024, he's played, I think, in some of the smaller tournaments fairly well. The Masters, he did not play well at all. So I guess my take and where I'm getting at is, like, he just recently became a big name in professional golf from last year's U.S. Open. And now he's kind of like, it's almost like he's like trying to phase out the guys that are trying to take the same route as him. I mean, there's guys that are trying to make, you know, trying to win a tournament here to make their, you know, their name and presence known in professional golf like he did. And it's almost like he's just stay humble. Like, don't phase out these guys that have the same dream as that he did into making professional golf, making a lot of money, winning tournaments, winning majors, etc. And saying, here, we're going to just only have the top 100 golfers, and every year 20 drop, and then we get a new 20. For me, because it came from him, a guy that just recently has become kind of a superstar in the PGA Tour after last year's U.S. Open win, I'm just like, you know, knock that shit off. Now, if it was someone like Rory McIlroy, who I think also has kind of said comments similar, but just not to the exact degree with the 100 golfers and so forth, or maybe even a Jordan Spieth, maybe. I don't know. I would still be, you know, it's just, why are we trying to phase out the guys that have a dream, the same dream that they have? You know, we got guys in the Corn Ferry Tour who are working their asses off just to get in the top 30, to get their tour card, to show up in 2025, to start playing in tournaments and seeing, you know, if they can make their name. So why are we trying to make that road tough? I just don't get that from professional golf. We're talking about a sport where we're trying to expand the presence worldwide from different generations, both from the men's and women's side, you know. And my issue is when Wyndham Clark and a couple of other of these guys in the PGA Tour make these bullshit comments, that to me it just sounds like we're trying to make this more difficult for guys to get to the PGA because we want to play the best of the best. For me, that's for sure. I mean, it just, you know, and people can argue me with this one, and it's fine. I mean, I'm sure there's valid reasons on the other side of it. It's for someone that, you know, I like seeing these guys, you know, like an Oshke, who's really trying to, you know, he wins a tournament this year. He's one of those up-and-coming golfers that I get excited to see tournament, you know, for him in tournaments. And, you know, it's just, I don't get that from why these certain pros are, again, trying to make it difficult for Corn Ferry guys or guys that are aspiring to become professional golfers out of college and so forth. I just don't get it. My other take is like, okay, Wyndham, why are you fucking doing that? you know, every year, Corn Ferry, top 30, get their tour cards and they go up to the PGA and, you know, and there's guys that do get relegated down. I mean, there's guys that went to live. I think they lost their tour cards. We all knew Ricky Fowler a couple of years ago was about to lose his tour card. And, you know, so, I mean, golfers do lose their tour card and guys from the Corn Ferry get come up. It's a system we've been doing for quite, you know, for a while now. And so it's like, when, I don't know, you know, to Wyndham Clark, like, you're aware of this, right? Like, again, it's not 100 golfers and we're moving up 20 and dropping 20, but it's the same damn process. Unless I'm missing something or I'm not aware of something, you know, I don't know. Again, it's just the comments that just didn't really sit well for me, and mainly maybe from him. Just because, again, he's fairly new as far as being a bigger name in professional golf, mainly because of his U.S. Open win last year. He didn't win that. I think he's known, but his stardom is not as high as it is right now. And again, if this came from the other golfers too, I would have the same issue, you know, other than maybe like a Rory McIlroy, whose resume blows Wyndham Clark's resume out of the water, right? And I would still have an issue with it, even if Rory said it. I would just kind of maybe respect it a tad more than what Wyndham said. And again, Wyndham hasn't really done much so far in 2024. So, I mean, we'll see how this year goes. But if you're going to make those comments, and then we look at the end of the year, and you're in the bottom 20, like, you're going to be eating your own damn words there. So, I mean, that's just the. In general, those kind of comments piss me off. Is for, you know, just, again, staying humble, enjoying being a star in the PGA Tour, because, again, it's a luxury that not everybody gets. He gets it. Good for him. He's earned it. But there's guys that are working towards that. Let's not make the road any harder than it is. It's already difficult enough to become a PGA pro. Why are we trying to make this even more? So that's just my take here. Okay, so last episode, got to interview awesome caddy on the Corn Ferry Tour, JP Burke. And, you know, he's caddying for a guy on the Corn Ferry, Austin Head. And so I've been kind of following along what they've been doing the last few weeks. I got excited. This was a couple weeks ago. So Austin Hitt, he was sitting 27th at the time in the points, 219 points so far in the Corn Ferry Tour. Again, like I mentioned, the top 30 to get their tour card. So Austin Hitt, a long season ahead of us, was sitting at 27th. And he started off the year real well recently after their break. He's had a couple of slow starts. But I got excited at the Lecom Suncoast Classic. He was going into Saturday, he was tied fourth for the round. I messaged JP, right? I DM'd him, said, "Hey, you and Austin doing big things. Room for you guys Saturday, Sunday. Let's finish strong here." JP gave me a thumbs up. Unfortunately, that did not happen. But hey, you know, looking at what Austin's done and JP have done together this year so far, and against the long season ahead of them, we're definitely rooting for these two. And, you know, like we mentioned on the last episode when I was talking with JP, hoping we can get Austin on here, both of them at the same time, maybe towards the end of the season, and kind of recap how the year went. Hopefully by that point, he's got his tour card. Maybe he can, you know, wave it on the screen here in front of us to show off here. But we're going to definitely keep tabs on these two and really keep tabs. Look, I'm going to start trying to get more in-depth on the Corn Ferry side because I think there are a lot of good golfers that are going to make their way to the tour very soon. And getting to know who's out there right now on the Corn Ferry and watching some of these tournaments, you know, that's kind of my game plan moving forward. So I do want to get more in touch with the Corn Ferry side to share with everybody here. All right, so I think, you know, we've talked quite a bit of really the Masters, several different golfers, Liv going to Bolingbrook. Oh, I guess there's another thing. I guess before I wrap it up here, I forgot to mention the other big news in Liv golf is the news that they're going to possibly go to four rounds starting possibly next year. I think it's still under consideration. Now, listen, I do not think this is, how do I want to say this? I think this move is really mainly to just shut people up. I think people have really shit on the guys that went to Live. They're only playing three rounds, so they can't figure out how to play four rounds of golf, win a tournament. Listen, Brooks Koepka goes to Live, gets healthy, because he gets all that time off, which I think I've mentioned before on one of my episodes here. And we saw Live guys play four rounds of golf last year. One of them ends up winning a major. They all played well. I mean, technically Ron wins a major too, but he won it while he was still a PGA pro, PGA member, not a Live member. It has nothing to do with these guys don't have the stamina to play four rounds of golf. I mean, whoever pushes that narrative or whoever started the narrative is, you know, again, kind of an idiot, to be honest with you. I mean, these guys are playing practice rounds, pro-ams, and before the tournament starts, I mean, these guys are playing almost every God-blessed day. So I don't understand where someone pushed the narrative that these guys can't play four rounds of golf. They've been playing four rounds of golf before Liv, no issues. All of them had won, no issues. Biggest crock of shit comment that anybody's ever pushed. Again, I think that maybe it was just to stir up stuff. I don't know. It definitely worked. You can even see, like, again, I'm circling back to Wyndham Clark because I know he's done it before, but he's not the only one. There's other PGA golfers that kind of shit on some of the LIV guys that they can't compete to this level anymore because their stamina is only for three rounds of golf, not four. Again, I think that's just a stupid-ass comment. So there's moves to potentially four rounds. I think even the last week when I was watching one of the days, I forget which day of the tournament, might have been Friday, David Faraday even said there's consideration that they might go 5 days. And I think that was more of just a comment shot back at all the haters saying, yeah, we go from 3 to 5 because we're going to prove you guys that these golfers do have the sample. I think realistically they're going to end up at 4. And I think it's realistic, you know, just really to shut people up. I think once it goes to 4, those stupid comments go away. And then at the end of the day, it's you take all this the variables from LIV and PJ out of it, and it's then 4 rounds of golf against 4 rounds. People don't like the team concept with LIV. I've grown to start and like it because it's not really a Ryder Cup team style per se. You're playing individual and you're collectively putting your scores together with the team. So even if you're down at the bottom of the tournament, you have really no reason to withdraw or really not try because your team could be at the top. So it would be in your best interest for your team to play that third round at a high level to see if your team can then overall win if you guys are not in the individual winners. So I kind of grown to like that because we see in the PGA Tour some guys that, at least not some of the older golfers, or I should say more seasoned, experienced golfers, we've seen it time to time, they make up a bogus, bullshitted reason. They don't make the cut, or they barely make the cut. They're nowhere in contention. And then you see WD next turn. Oh, I got an ouch. I think truly that they bullshit that because they go, why do I want to be here? I'm not going to win and make the big money. I made the cut, so I'll just take my little check and get out of here early. I think that's kind of stupid. You know, I think that's just kind of BS. I mean, it's your job, it's your profession. If I try to do that in my job, I'm pretty sure I get fired the next day. You know, I put in my effort every day. That's the reason why I've kind of enjoyed the team concept part of LIV. It keeps everybody from the top to the bottom in the tournament. But other than that, I mean, like I said, it would be 4 rounds of golf at a golf course versus 4 rounds, you know, at the LIV versus 4 rounds at a golf course at the PGA Tour level. And at the end of the day, I think that's all people care about is, and then, you know, hopefully at some point we're going to merge and really put all the noise to a rest. I think that at some point it's going to be here in the next year or two. We'll see it. But until then, we do still have LIV versus PGA. And before they merge, maybe we'll see a LIV versus PGA Ryder Cup style tournament. You know, well, who knows? We'll see. Okay, now let's get towards what I think how I've always ended majority of my episodes here. When I say majority, because I only got 3 so far. So, you know, got a lot here. You know, I don't want to say they're my tips for amateur golfers, but stuff that I think amateur golfers can work on to help them improve. It's stuff that I've worked on. I work on at home, whether it's in my office, in the backyard, I go to the range, whatever the case is. And, you know, again, I'm not a professional. I'm not a pro here. I'm not a certified teacher here. So you take what I say with a grain of salt here. If you do it and it helps, awesome. You know, let me know. If you do it and you consistently try and something's not clicking, reach out to me in the DMs. Maybe we can try to figure it out. If not, tell me my tips suck, and that's okay. One of the biggest things that you see on Saturdays and Sundays with amateur golfers, your weekend golfers, is trying to make different changes throughout the round. And I think we see this a lot because, again, I think my last episode I talked about, you know, everyday golfers have everyday, you know, potentially 9-to-5 jobs, office jobs, whatever it is. Golf is not our profession. Golf is what we like to do for fun, and it's so we just, you know, not everybody has the time to put in 10 hours into our chipping and our driving and our putting and so forth. I think we all wish we had the time and the money to do so, but we don't. And we see a lot of guys on the course trying to make swing changes, which in general, for me, I've always tried to tell people, don't do it. Get through the round and what you're doing right now. At least don't make the drastic changes, because it's not the time or place. The drastic changes have to happen on the range, where you can just beat balls, work on the mechanics. If the mechanic change is what, you know, you're currently working. But there are minor changes on the course to kind of help us along, at least get through the round when certain things aren't going right. And one of my biggest things, or changes I like to say that you can try to do on the course without practicing, is really it's the ball placement in your stance. And I think certain level amateurs don't understand or grasp the concept of where the ball placement in your stance has to be for certain shots. I mean, in general, the ball towards your front foot, if you're a righty, it's towards your left. You're the opposite, towards your right. You know, if the ball is further up in your stance, in general, the basic science around it, at least with your irons and stuff, the ball's going to go higher up in the air. And the further back in your stance, you know, the lower the trajectory. And what we see, too, it's like guys will consistently have the ball further up their stance for all their shots, even their wedges and so forth. You know, you get to like an 8-iron and the ball is closer to their front foot than their middle of the stance or even their back foot. And what do we see? We see guys top it. We see them kind of, you know, do the pull tug a little bit. And why do we see that? It's because by the time that they had grazed the grass, they haven't made any contact with the ball as the club is coming up is when they're making contact with the ball. Simple changes like that, just moving the ball back in your stance, I think really does make a difference. And it also will help amateur golfers understand, because there will be times where you've got to put the ball low or hit the ball high and so forth. And making that change in the ball position really does make a huge difference. A couple other just little tidbits here that I, you know, stuff that you can do as amateurs is holding off your follow through to kind of get like a lower trajectory swing there. Basically, it's like, you know, just as soon as you make contact, almost like try to hold it off your swing. It's not finished all the way through. That is, you know, a way to, especially on these windy days, you know, if you're at least in the Midwest, you know, in the springtime, right now, we get windy rounds. I mean, real windy. And this, what I, you know, I like to call the sawed-off follow through, really will help in those certain rounds, is keeping the ball low. I mean, the lower you can keep the ball in windy conditions, especially if you're playing a course where you're getting some tree coverage too, the ball won't be as affected by the wind. You know, if you're going to hit the ball up in the air, the wind will start knocking it down, pushing it back to the right, etc. So, I mean, and that's, again, the sawed-off follow-through, something that I think you should try to work on at the range, but it's definitely something where I don't think it would hurt you if you all of a sudden did that on the course mid-round, if you've never done it before. Another tidbit. Again, this is, I think I wrote this down after I just played nine holes in what should have been like a freaking tornado, felt like at times. Because all of mine, I'm looking at my notes right now, written down, look like they're all wind related. When you're on the tee box with your driver, maybe your three wood, or even like a, four iron, three iron, 300, whatever your case is. Everybody always tees up their balls really high. You see a lot of people do that. In general, teeing up your ball high, you see the long drive guys do it because that's going to help them get the ball up in the air and stay in the air hopefully longer. Windy days, I don't think you really want to do that. You're trying to hit them low. You want the balls to roll if it's dry out. And teeing the ball low will definitely help do that. Another thing, but this is, again, not something I would try. Course, if you've never done it before, your drivers are not clubs that we hit generally down on, always hit up on, just trying to hit the ball up in the air. Tiger Woods is one of the few golfers still on tour this day that I believe still hits down on his driver, which is a concept in my head. I still can't wrap my mind around it, but I started trying that last year, and I'm known as a guy that hits the ball pretty high up in the air with most of my clubs. So when I started kind of getting down on this driver last year on a windy day, it was night and day for me. The ball was extremely low, shot out there. I got it to draw a little bit, and the ball ran out. It was midsummer, so it was dry out. It was a shot that I never thought I would have in my repertoire. Now I kind of do. It will get me in trouble here and there, but in general, just teeing up your ball low with your same swing does wonders, especially on windy days. And again, like I said, I must have written this down after playing or practicing on a windy day, because my last key is here: understanding what the wind's going to do to your ball throughout the round. When it is over 10 miles per hour wind, that ball's going to move. Whether it's on the putting green, you're in the fairway, the rough, or on the tee box, the wind will factor your ball movement. And I think understanding, the direction of the wind, understanding, what this could do while you're on the putting green and so forth, I think in general will help you, get better scores, lower scores, hopefully. Again, if they don't, DM me, tell me I'm a piece of shit, tell me I'm wrong. If it works out, DM me and tell me I'm awesome. I'm just kidding, but it would be good to know if anybody out there does follow some of these tips I do provide. Again, these are tips that I get from my own swing coach and from other just watching golf channel, all the different shows and stuff. So stuff that I also, I like practicing. I like going to the range, so I do practice a lot of these different shots too. So if you ever do get the chance and you do get to go to the range, it's not a bad idea to try to practice a shot you might only need to use once in a round. But knowing that you have that in your bag just in case, because you never know when you're going to need it, that always works. And that's kind of what I do. I go through a routine myself just to get ready, and then I go through my, what I call my bullshit swings. Shit that I hope doesn't happen in the round, but if it does, I'm prepared. I'm ready. So that's all I got for you guys today. We talked a lot. We got the PGA Championship coming up here, so hopefully this time around I'll record and I'll have an episode ready for you guys shortly right after the PGA tournament. Let me know what you guys think about those tips if you guys take them, and as always, let's go low.
Powered by Riverside.
That's too bad.